This is the Hockey News Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Hockey News Podcast. I'm your host today, Edward Fraser, here with Ryan Kennedy and Matt Larkin. I am hosting today because you, the fans, have, I may say wisely, banished Ken Campbell from the podcast for today for his stance on the NHL during the Olympics. For those of you who don't know, he has decided to, I guess, boycott?
Boycott.
You know, because it's not good to watch good hockey.
No.
I mean, why would you do that?
No.
And it's not like we're busy at this time of year. It's not like it's the trade deadline.
No. So instead of me being back at my desk editing our upcoming Future Watch edition, I'm here with these two knuckleheads hosting the podcast. Not that I don't enjoy it, of course.
No, of course not.
All right. Well, let's get started. We're going to focus mostly on trade deadline leading up to that. Of course, we had a trade yesterday. Today? This morning?
It was late last night.
Late last night.
Peter Mrazek to the Philadelphia Flyers. They've got some goaltending issues with injuries. Let's start off with your thoughts on that trade.
For me, it feels like the way the market is right now and the fact that the Flyers are missing both Brian Elliott and Michael Neuwirth, I feel like Detroit could have squeezed a little more out of Philly on this deal. Like, as it is, you have a conditional fourth round pick in 2018 and a conditional third rounder in 2019 going to Detroit. It doesn't seem like a lot because, particularly with the 2018, you know, it can become a third if the Flyers make the playoffs and Mrazek wins five games in the regular season. So it's like, okay, well, that's possible. That's pretty possible. But still only a third rounder. It can become a second if they win two rounds and Mrazek wins six games. He'll probably win six games, but they're not winning two rounds. I mean, you could be facing Tampa in the first round as a wild card spot. And even if you're in your own division, you're going to have to go through Pittsburgh and or Washington and Columbus. I don't see it happening. So, I mean, for Philly, it's great because they get a young goaltender who has had some pretty dramatic ups and downs in Detroit. But, I mean, there's still potential there. And it feels like they got him for practically nothing.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it was a pretty low-risk ad for Philly. And, I mean, Michael Neuwirth and Brian Elliott, we know who they are at this point. They're glorified 1Bs for the rest of their career. They're never going to establish themselves as bona fide long-term 65-game-a-year starters. Both guys are on short-term deals, and both have pretty long-term injuries. I mean, it could be the rest of the regular season for both guys. And what I like about it is, like you said, Ryan, Mrazek's had some ups and downs, but he does have some leftover upside. He's still in his mid-20s. He's shown flashes of very special potential. Even a couple years ago, before a big slump, he was even in the Vezina Trophy discussion halfway through the year. So there is talent there. So I think it's kind of an addition for Mrazek. And yes, he's an RFA this summer, but if Mrazek plays really well and kind of takes the Flyers on his back over the next couple months, I don't think it's inconceivable that he could start for the Flyers next year while they're waiting for their mega prospect Carter Hart and also Felix Sandstrom to come along. It would mean, you know, maybe having to trade a Neuwirth or an Elliott, but I don't think they'd be the hardest guys to trade either because they're pretty cheap and they're on short-term deals. Yeah.
Just like to remind Flyers fans out there longing for a decent goalie that they once had, Sergei Bobrovsky.
Yeah, don't remind them of that.
All right, so we've had one trade of significance, if you want to call that a trade of significance. I don't think I'd file that under that. Let's look to some other players who are almost certain to be moved at the deadline as it approaches. Ryan, let's start with you.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Rick Nash of the New York Rangers. This one just feels so telegraphed. You know, we've heard his name bandied about quite a bit. And you look at him, I mean, he's a guy that he's a veteran, he can score, he can do a lot of different things on the ice. He's a big body guy. He plays that heavy hockey that you want in the playoffs. It just feels like, I mean, the New York Rangers have literally come out and said, look, we got to move some guys. We got to kind of start turn a new page over. And they didn't say rebuild, but it's a rebuild.
It's a retool. I see it more like what San Jose did.
Yeah, exactly.
San Jose's in a much better position than the Rangers were at that time. But
New York's, they're not going to bottom out per se, but they're going to, they're going to get some new blood in, and they're going to get some assets for the veterans they trade. And with Rick Nash, he just seems like a no-brainer. And I mean, one team that I would really look at is the Boston Bruins, and I believe we've talked about this on the podcast before, where, if you put him on the second line of the Bruins, because, I mean, you're not going to touch the Bergeron line. They're the best in the league.
Sure.
But you put him on the second line, and all of a sudden the Bruins become like a real tricky matchup in the playoffs. And, I mean, they have so many other good things going for them right now at every position that I think, if you could add Nash, that'd be great. And the Bruins, they have some really nice prospects and a pretty deep pool to draw from, where you could offer the Rangers a player who's pretty close to the NHL, and maybe there's a pick or two involved as well. But I think they would have the right type of pot to offer the Rangers in exchange for Nash.
It's a good pick. I think Nash is going for sure. I'm going to stick with the rental as well. My guy, my definitely gone guy, is Mike Green. I know there's been some talk. I know Ken brought it up on a recent podcast that Ken Holland's not going to give away Mike Green if the offer isn't good enough. But I think the offer is going to be good enough because it's a right shot, mobile defenseman, expiring contract. There's going to be a lot of suitors for Mike Green. I think he's been linked. I mean, I know to the Washington Capitals for a possible reunion. Toronto Maple Leafs are a team that's looking for a right shot guy. I think Tampa Bay is going to be the team that gets Mike Green. If you could slide Jake Dochen down the lineup and you have a top four of Hedman and Mike Green and Sergachev and Anton Strahlman, I think that's very deadly, and it really solidifies the Lightning as a top Stanley Cup contender. And the Lightning have the right mix of what they can offer. They can surrender a first round pick, which I do think is going to be necessary to get Mike Green, and maybe a prospect, maybe a Libor Hayek and a first rounder for Mike Green. A trade like that is something I could picture, and I think Tampa Bay is going to be the team to get him.
I'd be shocked, honestly, if that's the amount that it takes to get a Mike Green out of there. I think that the Duchesne trade from earlier in the year set the bar way too high. I mean, we're talking about a rental player. Now, I get it. It's a low first rounder for Tampa Bay.
Tampa Bay plays their card right, it's the 31st overall pick.
So that's fair enough. But at the same time, like, that's still, if there's a premium put on first rounders, but if you're Tampa, I guess you're going for it this year and you're trying to win this year. But yeah, to peel a guy out, to peel a rental to give away a first round draft pick, that's a steep price. I can see if you've got a guy under contract for a few more years at a decent chance, but yeah, that's a true rental in Mike Green, because he's going to get paid again this summer.
I'm looking at the Kevin Shattenkirk deal as because people do use comparables, right, in negotiations.
Yeah,
sets
fair.
The bar. Shattenkirk was a rental last year, right shot, and he got a first round pick and Zach Sanford, okay prospect.
Sure.
So that's kind of the gauge I have in my head, but who knows?
We'll see. You're not wrong. You're not wrong. Okay, so those are guys who are almost assuredly going to get dealt. Who should get dealt this trade deadline? Matt, let's start with you this time.
I want to see Max Pacioretty dealt. Obviously, he has another year left on his deal, so it's not guaranteed, but I'm glad you mentioned the Matt Duchesne trade, Ed, because it really set the bar for what you'd get for a pretty high-end forward who does have a year left on his deal. And Pacioretty, I think, has been a more effective player than Matt Duchesne over the past several seasons. I know he's a winger, but Pacioretty's right up there in goals over the past four or five seasons with the top guys. And he's cheaper than Matt Duchesne. Matt Duchesne was $6 million. Pacioretty is cap hit is $4.5 million. He's an extremely attractive, he's a super rental because you get him for this year and also a bit of next year. And with the bar with Duchesne, I mean, a first-round pick, second-round pick, three pretty strong prospects, I think Montreal has a chance to really turn around its future with one trade. And you could get a king's ransom for Pacioretty because of that bar set by Matt Duchesne. And it's not going to be hard selling Max Pacioretty. There's going to be a ton of teams interested in him. And the team I'm looking at, I mean, I know the Blues have been mentioned a lot as a team chasing him. I'd really like to see what he could do as a Pittsburgh Penguin. He's got the wheels to skate with a Sidney Crosby. And he plays sort of a simple game. It's not like he's going to compete with Crosby to be the puck handler on that line. I just think he's a really nice fit for Pittsburgh's kind of north-south speed game. I'd love to see him there.
Would that signify a full rebuild effort in Montreal?
Yes, and this and it's a great point, Ed, because what makes it complicated and why Pacioretty is not a guarantee to go is that if you're Mark Bergevin, if you make that trade, you're admitting, I failed, I'm the guy who traded for Shea Weber, who signed Carl Alsner. Yeah. I made win now moves, and now I'm rebuilding. So basically, it's like holding up a sign saying, fire me. And that's the problem.
And that's exactly that was exactly where I was going to lead into, is because then is that not the first domino to fall in a Shea Weber trade, in a Carey Price potential deal? Because you're not going to win within the, I mean, I guess in theory you could get back within the window of his contract. It's a long deal. But this is not a team like we're talking about with the Rangers that's just retooling. You know, this is a team that needs a full-on rebuild. And if they're going to go like that, I mean, you can re-up and try to win with this group again and go dive in it. But it's a tougher situation in Montreal than it is with some of the other teams.
Yeah, excellent point. It's so true. And that's why I think it's going to hold back possible deals like a guy, with a guy like Pacioretty, until a new GM comes in, maybe in the summer. But
Ryan, who should get dealt?
All right, this is a big one. This is a bit out of left field, but I feel pretty good about it. Matt Duchene.
Oh
yes. Here is my logic. Okay, so Matt Duchene, he's got 1 year left on his deal after this one, as Matt mentioned, $6 million. Then he becomes an unrestricted free agent. Now, if you're Matt Duchene, and keep in mind, he has heated up since that really cold start in Ottawa. So he's putting up points now. He is the Matt Duchene we thought he was. But if you're Matt Duchene and you look at the Ottawa Senators, is this a team you can see competing for a Stanley Cup in 2 or 3 years? No. Mm-hmm. If you're Matt Duchene, you want playoff success. He said that when he was traded from Colorado. He's like, I want to be in the playoffs. Of course, because fate is cruel. Ottawa is nowhere near the playoffs. Colorado may get in.
Yeah.
So if you're the Ottawa Senators and you're GM Pierre Dorion, who just signed an extension, do you want to lose Matt Duchene for nothing after next summer when you already gave a boatload to get him? Or do you want to flip him to the Columbus Blue Jackets for Alexander Venberg?
Ooh.
Now, you look at Columbus. They're in a dogfight right now. I believe Duchene would be a slight upgrade on Alexander Venberg.
Right now, yes.
Yeah, right now.
Yeah.
What you get is the chance, obviously, to woo Duchene for a contract extension. And you know, you say like, look at all the players we have here. We got a great goalie, Bobrovsky. We have two fantastic blue liners in Zach Werenski and Seth Jones. We got a bunch of guys up front that are pretty good. Pierre-Luc Dubois is looking like a really nice center. He's only going to get better. You could slot in with that forward core and do a lot of damage. And we're in the playoff mix already. We might even be better next year. If you're Ottawa, you get Venberg. Comes in with a cheaper cap hit. I believe he's 4.9. Signed long-term already. So you get Venberg for many more years than you'll have Duchene. Mm-hmm. And you have certainty there. And you know what? If you're Ottawa, again, you're not going to win in the next couple of years. However, you do have some good players coming up the pipeline. Logan Brown could be that number one center if you're patient.
Yep.
Thomas Chabot can be that top-pairing defenseman if you're patient. So you add Venberg in there. He helps bridge things. By the time those guys are up to speed, Venberg is still a very viable, you know, player down the middle. He could be a great number two. I feel it could work for both sides. I know it's kind of nuts, but that's my proposal.
No, I like it.
I like it.
My question after that, though, and I think I'm basically going to ask Matt here to put his column from his recent issue into verbal form is, then if you're looking to the future, what are you doing with Erik Karlsson?
Oh boy, I mean,
up to Erik Karlsson. Yeah, I think that's the answer.
I still think he's part of the solution, not the problem. It's not like he's 32 years old, right?
Yeah.
He's still what, 27 now at most.
Sounds right. Yeah.
And I mean I've said it before. I still think it sends a horrible message to the franchise if you're trading away the best player that's ever played for your franchise.
Sure.
With apologies to Daniel Alfredsson. I mean, Carlson's
won two
Norai. Yeah. He should have won four.
Yeah.
And when your owner's already talking about moving the team if attendance gets bad, and I mean, you had your worst attendance in 20 years. During the season you made the conference final, you're going to try and sell that fan base on a rebuild when you've covered up the 1,500 seats with tarps?
Mm-hmm.
Good luck. That's what I'm afraid of. But I think your proposal, Ryan Wenberg, I think is okay because you're getting a viable roster player coming back. But Carlson, trading Duchesne is not the same as trading Carlson.
No.
Trading Carlson is cutting up the franchise's heart.
Yeah, that's fair. I just wonder about the Mets because, as you said, this goes to Carlson then and his decision. And does this send the right message to him? If you're selling a player who is, I think we can all admit, Matt Duchesne, a little better right now than Wenberg. I mean, maybe you sell it as, okay, you know, this is a guy who's going to be able to help us. This is a guy who might be better in 2 years when we're ready to win Derek Carlson. But if you're going to try to keep him, you got to open up the purse strings, like full value on this guy. So you got to be willing to spend. And I agree with you. I think it's worth it. You don't trade a superstar.
Right.
Yeah. You don't trade a superstar.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's move on and talk about a player who has been in the rumor mill. Everybody's saying he's going to get dealt, but who won't be moved. Ryan?
I'm going to go with Chris Tanev of the Vancouver Canucks. I know there are several fan bases out there who really covet Chris Tanev because he's so good defensively. He's on such a nice contract in Vancouver, and he's not that old. But I think those are all reasons why Vancouver doesn't want to deal him. You look at the Canucks right now, and they're kind of rebuilding, but not quite. It really looks like they're going to re-sign Erik Gudbranson. Some Canucks fans might be apoplectic about that. Other Canucks fans might be okay with it. I'm just telling you what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, we've said this with some other guys, if you trade Chris Tanev, then you have to go start looking for a Chris Tanev.
Yeah, right.
Because I don't think the Canucks are that far off. I think it's not going to be next year, but you look at Elias Pettersson, you look at Thatcher Demko, you look at Olio Levy and Adam Gaudette. Those are all really nice prospects that have yet to play for your franchise, and maybe Demko's been called up once, I don't remember. But then you have Brock Besser, you have Bo Horvat, both young guys who are really looking good already. You got the Sedins who are old but great guys in the room, and who knows how long they're going to stick around, but I think they're the kind of guys where as long as they're not taking up too much of your cap space in the future, they're so valuable in so many different ways. And I think they figured out the right role for them under Travis Green.
And they're $3 million a year players starting next year if they come back at all.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And you're going to have all these guys on entry-level deals anyways, so that's going to help you there.
And they weren't that far out of the playoff race this season until they hit the wall.
They were competitive.
They were competitive. So even though a lot of teams want Chris Tanev, I just look at Trevor Linden and Jim Benning and think, like, I feel they value him as an asset too much to make him a trade deadline trade where you might not get full value because you're only dealing with a certain pool of teams who are buyers.
And Benning is now under no pressure to make a huge move because he's got full confidence of management after signing the extension.
Right. Exactly.
Good point.
Matt, who's not moving?
I'm going to say Mike Hoffman. And basically, you take Max Pacioretty, make him a year younger, add an extra year left on his deal, and you're going to trade that guy because why? Mm-hmm. I mean, Hoffman is not part of the problem in Ottawa. He's still in his 20s. He's very fast. His cap hit is $5.18 million, I believe. It's not unreasonable. I mean, he's paid fair value, maybe even slightly undervalued. And if I'm Ottawa, I mean, I still think Mike Hoffman, especially as a fast player, I mean, look at Patrick Marleau in his late 30s. He's still effective.
Yeah.
Mike Hoffman is still going to be an effective player in a couple years. And if you still haven't turned the franchise around in 2 years, then you get Mike Hoffman as a rental player. You can still trade for something great.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, I mean, I'd be focusing on shipping out. I mean, you've already gotten rid of Dion Phaneuf, but you focus on Derek Brassard and maybe Zach Smith, guys like that. Mm-hmm. Maybe Jean-Gabriel Pageau, but I think Pageau is pretty
useful
as well.
That one perplexes me.
He's still young. He's a good third-line center.
Yes.
So, yeah, I don't know. Hoffman, to me, I mean, yes, Ottawa is smart to start thinking rebuild, but that doesn't mean you trade every player, especially not talented, speedy players that are still in their 20s and are not done their prime. I mean, I still think you listen to offers, of course. Maybe someone offers you the moon for Hoffman, but I think that's the thing. You have to ask for the moon. So when there's been recent chatter this week of Pierre Dorion, his asking price getting too high for Hoffman, I believe it, and honestly, good for Dorion in that case, because it should take something fantastic to be willing to surrender Hoffman.
Yeah, like a first half of the first round pick and like a pretty high-level prospect, yeah. I think, is minimum asking price for Hoffman. Lots of eyes going to be on the Ottawa Senators as the trade deadline approaches, but which teams are under the most pressure to pull a big move off either on trade deadline day or leading up to it?
I'm going to go with the New York Rangers, and as I said before, it's almost guaranteed that Rick Nash is going to get moved, but there's a couple of players that could be moved by the Rangers, and this is a team that the pipeline is starting to get a bit better. It was really kind of slim for a couple of years there because they were trading picks, they were going for it, and that's what you do when you're in your Stanley Absolutely. Cup window. I don't fault them at all. But they had a great first round in 2017. They got Elias Anderson and Phil Kittle, both players who are already, playing in the pros, playing in the AHL, and both were at the World Juniors. So I think what you do now is you start getting into that sort of non-Rangers mindset of, like, let's get a bunch of picks. Let's try to get some prospects from other teams when we're making these deals. Nash is one big piece. We've heard Ryan McDonough's name out there. I think it would probably take a lot, and it should take a lot if you're going to pry Ryan McDonough out of Manhattan. But, I mean, if you're Jeff Gorton, you got to see what return you can get. And as I said before, they had that public letter to Rangers fans saying that, like, they know what they have to do and there's going to be some pain, but that's okay. And I totally agree with it. Now it's a matter of going out and executing that plan. And the trade deadline, I think, can be the start of that. We talked about, some teams, again, like with Vancouver and Tanev, like, they can be a little bit patient. But on the flip side, I think the Rangers need to take advantage of some of the buyers who are going for it. And maybe that, third round pick becomes a second round pick, or that second round pick becomes a first round pick, because you've got a team in a pressure point and you've got some really nice assets. And keep in mind, New York has had some really long playoff runs of late. Those guys in that core have a ton of experience. It's the type of experience you want. I think you can have a little sort of value added with guys like Nash and McDonough and, Grabner if he gets dealt. So I think they can make a lot of hay there.
Of course, the question has to come up then. Henrik Lundqvist.
I don't think he moves.
But why? I mean,
because he doesn't want to.
And I think you owe him that. I get that. Yeah, and I do. And I don't know how much of a return he would get at this point at his age. I don't know how many. I'd have to look more closely. But how many teams are in need of a goaltending upgrade heading into the playoffs this year? And could they even squeeze him in? But yeah, so I think that's fair. He just, you let him finish out his career with the Rangers. Okay, Matt, same question to you. Which team needs to make some big moves?
Interestingly enough, it's a team that could be a good trading partner with the Rangers. Step right up, Kevin Cheveldayoff, Winnipeg Jets. Yeah. This is your time. Yep. You've put in your work. You've got so many amazing prospects. Your team is young and amazing, exciting. Patrick Laine, Jacob Trouba, and Mark Scheifele, and Kyle Connor, and Jack Roslovic, and Connor Hellebuck.
Okay, we got time. Yeah.
Okay, so we know they're good enough now, right? Yeah. All these prospects have come to fruition. They don't need any more first-round picks. They still have even more good prospects in the system, guys like Logan Stanley. It's time to start cashing in those chips. That includes first-round picks. That includes maybe one of the prospects. Maybe it's a Logan Stanley. The Jets, what we know they need is experience. So they need, possibly, if they're going to search for a defenseman, maybe Ryan McDonough is the guy they need. So maybe you have to sacrifice a Logan Stanley to get a Ryan McDonough. Mm. They need better penalty killing. Maybe you get a Michael Grabner, another guy from the Rangers, who's even strength scoring machine, but also a shorthanded threat. Another guy I'd be looking at is Derek Brassard, because the Jets could use a better third-line center, I think. And Brassard has incredible playoff experience in the last couple of years. The last 2-3 years, he's up there with Carl Hagelin, Crosby, and Malkin as the guys who have played the most playoff games, because Brassard had a deep run with the Rangers in 2014 and the Senators last year, so he'd bring good experience to the table, versatility. And that's the thing. I mean, the Jets, it's time. I know Cheveldayoff has been pretty conservative GM, other than the Evander Kane trade a few years back, but he's waited in the weeds, and he's put in the proper work. The team is absolutely ready, I think, to really contend and make a deep run. I think it's going to be between the Jets and Nashville coming out of the Central. And to get that leg up on Nashville, who we can always assume is going to do something, because David Poile always does, I think Cheveldayoff is going to have to maybe strike first, or at least keep pace and make a trade of his own.
Yeah, I think got to throw Rick Nash into that mix as well as possible Rangers who could be moving to Winnipeg, because I think that's the type of player I think who the Jets could really benefit from as well.
Nash, and I've thought about that one before, and I've been asked about that one before, and the thing about Nash is, the Jets are so deep on the wings that if you put a Nash in the lineup, who is he displacing? I mean, do you want Kyle Connor to move down to your third or fourth line? I don't know for sure that you do. Or same with Matthew Perreault. I think they've both been better than Nash this year. So for me, if I'm the Jets, I'm looking more down the middle or on defense, unless the price for Nash turns out to be just dirt cheap, which I don't think it will be.
I think you can never have enough depth come playoff time, and the experience that he has, that he brings to a team, the leadership, I think, is invaluable. Yeah. And you get that from McDonough as well, don't get me wrong, but the price tag on a Nash is going to be a heck of a lot less
than it will
be on
McDonough. Yeah,
that's fair. So, I think we have to talk about it. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, though, on what happened with Smith-Pelly in Chicago recently. I think we can obviously all agree, absolutely deplorable. I think the reaction from both teams involved and the league was well orchestrated, well done. The Hawks have banned those fans, of course. Is there anything else that the league can do to either set a precedent here or to further condemn this type of behavior, though?
I would like to see the NHL ban those fans from every rink. I think that would be the final step. I mean, we know they're gone from the United Center, but I think that would send a really firm message that, you know, it's zero tolerance, and it would be consistent with the message of hockey is for everyone. And I'm just curious to see what's going to happen next year with Kim Davis, who's been brought in, and I think one of her main jobs as an executive with the NHL is going to be really pushing that agenda forward of hockey is for everyone and promoting inclusivity, because she checks two boxes. She's a woman and she's black, and I think she's an important new representative for the game. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see if she takes this incident into consideration when she starts making bigger decisions next year, because I know right now she's sort of just learning the NHL. She didn't come from a hockey background, from what I understand. So in terms of what to do going forward, I don't know. I mean, what can you do other than ban these guys? That would, to me, send a nice, strong message. And I think it's been great that other players like Anthony Duclair have stepped forward, and Wayne Simmons, and spoken out in support of Smith-Pelly. And I think that's all we can do for now, I guess.
Yeah, it's absolutely mind-boggling that this sort of stuff occurs in this day and age. Ryan, any further thoughts on this?
Well, yeah, it's funny you say it's mind-boggling, but I mean, if you look at the culture right now, especially on social media, it's not actually that surprising, sadly, because you have so much of this behavior that has become permissible, particularly in the last year or so. And I don't know about the feasibility of banning these fans like across the league. I'm just not sure how you can physically do it. I mean, it'd be great if they could, but I think what you have to do is keep having these conversations that people don't want to have. And frankly, I mean, there is a lot of privilege in hockey. It's still a very white sport. You know, these fans were sitting in like the best seats in the house, so clearly, you know, they could afford them. Ugh. And unfortunately, you know, it's still easy to target black hockey players, and it's so easy to get under their skin because the wounds are so raw. And, you know, in chanting basketball at them, you're basically saying like, you don't belong here. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's rough because there's no counter to that. Like, when you're as privileged as these fans are, like, the only thing you can do to, like, there's no epithet that's going to affect them other than saying, like, you're racist. And, like, some people will get upset and be like, I'm not a racist, you're the racist, which is just silly circular reasoning. But we've also got to the point where a lot of people out there don't even care if you call them racist anymore because they've been emboldened by the culture. And it's something that has to be worked on. And I think, you know, the responses from the Hawks and from the Caps and from the NHL were swift, and they were very good, and it was very positive in that light. And, you know, people are going to have to get uncomfortable. And I think that's what it's going to take is every time something happens, you have to have this reaction where people step up and say, no, we don't want that in our sport. We like all the athletes we have here. We like all the people involved in hockey, no matter what the color of their skin is, because that is our culture. It's a hockey culture. I mean, Devontae Smith-Pelly is from the Toronto area. Him being a hockey player is the most natural thing that could have occurred for him as a high level athlete. That's what he grew up around. It shouldn't be a weird thing, and it's not. And I think it's great that we have more players coming from different backgrounds, and in the U.S. we have them coming from so-called non-traditional hockey markets, and you know, the expansion in the NHL to the Sun Belt has really helped there. And just the growth of the sport means we're getting players who, you know, in the case of Seth Jones, his dad was a basketball player. And then you had Mark Alt, who was in Carolina's system. He might be with Philly now, I'm not sure. But his dad was a football player. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Justin Bailey's dad was a football player. You're seeing guys from different backgrounds and different races who they could have been athletes in other sports. But we're seeing them gravitate to hockey. Austin Matthews is another example. Played baseball when he was growing up. We're seeing them gravitate to hockey, and that's an awesome thing because the pool is getting bigger, the talent is getting better, and the fan base is going to get better as a result. And those are all positive things, and hopefully the people that disagree with that get left behind.
Well, let's just hope, and sadly I don't think it will be, but let's hope we never have to talk about this again.
Right.
Because it never happens again. Let's move on to something a little more positive and finish off the podcast with an interview with the ever wonderful to speak with Roberto Luongo. Absolutely fantastic interview. Matt had a chance to talk with him for a project that we're working on. Our collector's edition for later this year is going to be the top 100 goalies of all time. We're just kind of starting to get into it, but boy, it's a fun project already, and gives an opportunity for us to talk to some of the game's greatest, and Luongo certainly falls into that category. Here's Matt's chat with him.
I guess first of all, can you take me back to when you were first traded to Florida? So I guess after your rookie season, and now that you have, you know, years between the trade and now, how do you look back on it in terms of how you felt at the time versus how you feel about it now?
This is from Islanders to Florida, you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean it was a weird day. I remember it was a draft day, and earlier that morning they had traded Kevin Weeks away to another team, so in my mind I figured, oh well, they're going to give me a shot this upcoming year, so I was pretty excited about it. And within the hour I got a call from I think it was Butch Goring. Mm-hmm. So I assumed it was just to, you know, to let me know that they had traded the other goalie away and that they were going to give me a shot next year and all that stuff, but it was actually to inform me that they had also traded me to Florida. So I was kind of a little bit surprised by it. I didn't really know how to feel, to be honest with you. I mean, it was my first year in the NHL, so obviously I was, you know, upset. But you know, I was young, and I was able to get over it pretty quickly.
For sure. And if people ever say to you, you know, it goes down as one of the worst trades in history by Mike Milbury, is there a part of you that kind of feels the satisfaction, like, yeah, that's right, that kind of thing?
No, not really. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I was young, and you know, sometimes you don't know how things are going to pan out, right? And it's easy to say that, you know, looking back now, but at the time, you know, who knows how it could have played out. But for me, obviously, it was something that in the end was the most important thing that happened to me in my life, because I was able to, you know, meet my wife, and now we have a family, and I live there, and I'd say it turned out okay for me.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I remember you've told this to me before, that Grant Fuhr was a goalie that you really idolized growing up. Could you just go into a bit more detail about that and just kind of what about him stood out and made you really idolize him?
Yeah, I think, I mean, he was the goalie that attracted me to the position in the first place, and just watching him, I used to love the way he used to make those glove saves. I thought it was so, like, jaw-dropping, exciting, you know, inspiring. I used to try to mimic him at home all the time. whether it was somebody shooting on me or just throwing ball at myself or whatever it was. I was always just trying to replicate those glove saves that I used to make, and that's the main reason why I decided to be a goalie, because I just loved making those kind of saves.
For sure. It's funny, I was at the Leafs-Columbus game last night and talking to Frederik Andersen, who made 54 saves.
Yeah.
And he's on pace for one of the highest totals ever in shots faced in a season, but he's not on pace to catch your two seasons with Florida. It's your two seasons and Gump Worsley for the most shots ever faced. And Andersen said to me last night that he it's fun when he gets that many shots. So do you remember it that way in Florida, or was there ever a point where it was like, okay, guys, I need some help here. This is too much.
No, you know what? I mean, I always play better when I get more shots. I mean, that's it just keeps you more in the game, keeps you involved, and you know, keeps you sharp, I find. So I always find that my best games have always been the ones where, you know, I faced about 40 shots or so. So, I mean, obviously it depends on the quality of shots. You don't want to be giving up like 10 breakaways a game, but for the most part, I mean, those are always the games that I play better at.
Cool. And in the Canucks part of your career, obviously one thing that was unique about it was you were the first goalie, I think, in 50 years to be named a captain of a team. And now it's been several years since then. So I'm curious how you look back on it. And was it something that you were excited about in the moment? And did you like it? Was it uncomfortable? Was it weird? Or just what are your thoughts?
I loved it. I, to be honest with you, I thought it was a great... at first, when they asked me to, you know, I wasn't quite sure how to feel about it, because it was a great honor, obviously, but it had never been done, you know, in the recent memory and stuff like that. So, but I loved it. I loved being, you know, the leader of the team in that regards, in that sense. It was a great experience. I wish I had a bit more maturity as far as experience wise under my belt, so I could have handled it maybe a little bit better in certain situations. But at the end of the day, if I had a chance to do it all over again, I would. I thought it was one of the best experiences.
Cool. And from a nuts and bolts perspective, you know, during a game, a captain can at least be on the bench with his teammates. But if you're playing, it's almost like, would you have to skate over to the bench during a timeout and say, come on, guys, let's do this? Or how do you remember kind of dealing with those kind of moments?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the... didn't really change the way I was or what I had to do during a game. You know, everything pretty much stayed the same. The only difference was obviously, you know, there was a bit more commitments with the media, post games, and that kind of stuff. But we had, you know, assistant captains that would handle the duties as far as talking to the refs and all that kind of stuff. So it was more of a symbolic thing more than anything else. You know, there was a few nuances here and there.
For sure. And in your time with Vancouver, obviously it was a great, productive part of your career, and I assume a lot of good memories, but also, of course, the Game 7 loss to Boston. So when you look back on it now, do you still feel the sting of the 2011 loss, or does the good still outweigh the bad?
Well, the good definitely still outweighs the bad. I mean, there were so many great memories, but the sting of that loss will never go away, just because never had a chance to go back to the final. So, you know, until that happens, hopefully it will. You know, that will always be in the back of your mind as a what if, you know. And that being said, though, I mean, there were so many other great memories that were made over the course of my time there. That definitely outweighs that, and even that whole playoff run was special in its own way. You know, it's a bummer that it had to end that way. But you know, in all, that whole playoff run was amazing. Starting from the first round against the Blackhawks, where we were up 3-0 in the series, they came back to tie it 3-3, and then we're up 1-0 in the final game. They tied it shorthanded at the end, and then we won in overtime. Like that's one of the most amazing memories that I'll have.
Oh yeah, that was Burrows, right? That scored in Game 7.
Yeah, that's
that
right.
Game. I remember that game. That was nuts. And I think obviously you're going to finish. You might end up top three in wins all time, around there, maybe top two. Who knows? Depending on how much longer you want to play. But I also think, on top of your numbers and your accomplishments, one thing that people will always remember about you, even years from now, is Strongbone, and the decision to become so big on social media. And I do think it's a crucial defining trait about you and makes you unique compared to every other player in the league. So I'm just kind of curious about when you first started doing it and what made you kind of decide, okay, I'm going to start, you know, making this a bigger thing and doing it more often. And do you remember when you decided to do it?
Well, I remember, I think it was, I don't remember the year. I was probably, do you have it? I don't remember.
I think it was like, I remember when, because for a while it was, is it Luongo?
It
was a mystery.
Well, it was never really intent to become that big, to be honest with you. It was just something that, you know, I started to have amongst friends, and then a couple teammates that started following me, and then people realized that, you know, they look at who people follow, and people started following me. And then one of my teammates, I think was Ryan Kessler, just once tweeted out like an encrypted message about, you know, me. And then it just started growing, you know, more and more. And then, because I never really came out and fully admitted that it was me, and I'm not verified either. And that was the whole point of the account.
Yeah.
Just to keep a little bit of mystery behind it, but at the same time to keep it lighthearted and fun. To me, that's what matters. It's not important to have a blue check mark or to, you know, I just wanted to keep it a little bit different, a little bit light, and just to show maybe a little bit more of my personality that sometimes that it's hard to bring out in front of the cameras, because when you're in front of the cameras, obviously you want to keep it, you know, politically correct and you know, don't stray too far away from you know, the hockey terms that everybody uses.
Right, and I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because I did want to ask you about that, too, and that, you know, I think that you're one of the personalities that stands out the most in the game, and there's obviously guys like PK Subban as well, and it still seems like you guys are the exception rather than the rule, and especially compared to, you know, the NBA, the NFL. And I'm just curious, why do you think hockey culture is different? Because it seems like there's always that battle where players try to hold back, and if they say something that they regret, they kind of clam up, and later in the career they talk less. It seems unique to hockey compared to the other big sports. So I'm just curious what you think is the reason for it.
I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. I just think that's just the way it's always been. And once, you know, it's tough to break that mold, right? And just like with anything else in life, you know, when you're used to having something a certain way and somebody tries to do something different, it's hard for people to understand or accept it. And it's tough to break barriers. You know, you can say that about so many things in life. So not that this is has anything to do about breaking barriers, but you know what I'm trying to say. It's tough to change something when people have seen it one way for so long and do something the same way for so long, and having somebody or people, you know, try to do things a little bit different. So most of the time it's tough for people to accept that.
Right. And being a guy who often has, you know, colorful or interesting things to say, does that ever weigh on you, or sort of, you know, if you have a game where you don't want to talk, but you know that people kind of have come to expect it from you because you're a funny guy and you're a pretty honest guy compared to a lot of other players?
I mean, maybe a little bit early on in my career, it was a bit harder for me to digest those types of things, so always having to talk and being, you know, that kind of stuff. But, you know, just getting older and maturing and understanding how things work, I've gotten to the point where I understand certain things and I get it. So I accept it and embrace it more now, and just makes me as a person more relaxed and not as uptight, and knowing that that kind of stuff, you know, is part of the job. It's part of the description to be able to do these things on a daily basis and not to be not to resist it.
Good. And lastly, I really do think it's fair to say that social media and NHLers wouldn't be the same without you. Like, I think that you are the guy that sort of blazed a new trail that others have since followed. Yeah, I think everyone would agree with that. So I'm curious, is that something that you kind of take pride in, and you'll look back and say, yeah, you know, I'm going to win close to 500 games or maybe more, but I also am the social media guy? And is that, you know, that you can kind of hang your hat on as well?
I mean, I don't know. It's tough to say, but it's funny because a lot of people get recognized more. I get called Strombone more than Roberto nowadays. So it's kind of funny that how things worked out. But you know, listen, I'm at the end of the day, I was just trying to to show people who I was when I'm just hanging out with guys or at home and stuff like that, and not always in business attire, as they would say. So I'm glad people took to it and enjoy it, and hopefully it'll be like this for a long time, and people could just remember me by social media, even when my days of playing hockey are long gone.
Good, awesome.
A big thanks to Roberto for taking the time to speak with us. That's all we've got on the podcast for this week. We'll be back next week, and I don't know, will Ken be back?
He'll be back. He'll be freed from his cage, I guess, and we'll be talking about, the post-trade deadline fallout.
Yeah. Do we want Ken back? I guess. Let's see if we can get Keep Ed, hashtag Keep Ed, trending on Twitter. Somehow, I don't think that's going to happen. Anyways, thanks so much for listening, guys. Appreciate it. For Ryan and Matt, I'm Edward Fraser. Thanks for listening.